Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to another episode on the New Books Network. I'm one of the hosts, Dr. Miranda Melcher, and I'm very excited today to be interviewing Ralph Hope about his book titled The Grey Men, Pursuing the Stasi into the Present, published by One World in 2022, which looks at the East German state security service that was so dominant during the period of the German Democratic Republic, the GDR, East Germany. Where during the time that they were in charge, they amassed billions of pages of records on everyone really in the country and a lot of people outside of it. And yet when the Berlin Wall falls, suddenly this organization no longer has a reason to exist. And what happens to all of these employees who are suddenly unemployed? That's exactly what this book details and explains a number of things about how the organization worked, what happened afterwards, and answer some of the questions that we might have had about things that didn't happen, specifically anyone being particularly prosecuted for their role in this very known to be brutal security service. So this book answers a lot of questions that I'm sure I'm not the only one who maybe didn't really realize I had these questions until I read it. So thank you very much for joining us and sharing your thoughts and insights.
Hello, Miranda. Thank you.
Could you please start off by introducing yourself and your background and through that explain why you decided to write the book?
Yes. I served as an FBI agent for more than 25 years. Most of that time, I was a street agent, which is really all I wanted to be. My specialty was violent crimes, drug trafficking organizations, kidnappings, extortions, and the like. I wanted to catch the bad guy, and I wanted to protect the victims. After 9/11, I raised my hand, as many FBI agents did, to focus on international terrorism. It just so happened that I had a background in international relations. And so shortly after raising my hand, I found myself on a joint terrorism task force. And then shortly after that, working for extended periods of time, months in the Middle East, Asia, Central Asia, the various stands, Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, and so forth. I was then appointed as the deputy head of the FBI office in the Baltic states. And it was then that I started running into not only former KGB or current and former KGB officers, but also some people that were identified to me as former Stasi officers in my various meetings that I was having. And I started going to Germany from time to time, work-wise, and I had a question. I'm an investigator, so I have a lot of questions. This question was, what happened to the Stasi officers after the wall came down, after unification in 1990? And I started asking that question, and I didn't really get a satisfactory answer. And that's where this book came from.
Fascinating. Thank you for explaining that. I think it's really clear that your background in the FBI as an investigator does give you both unique access, obviously, to people, but also really has honed your kind of asking of questions that comes throughout this book in really helpful and insightful ways. So I'd love to ask you about kind of some of the main points in the book where you eventually essentially track down this answer of what happened to the Stasi after the wall fell. But in order to kind of set the stage for that, can you explain to us what the state was of the Stasi when the wall fell? How many people worked for it? How did someone become an employee? Kind of who were these people that then suddenly became unemployed?
Before I address that, there's one additional point on the question that I had that I think intrigued me and caused me to go down this journey. And that was when I asked that question in Germany to the average citizen, to the person on the street, that would be old enough to know. What I received in answer is a look of quiet desperation, I would say. When I asked people in government, in current police and intelligence services, not only in primarily in Germany, in this case, I received what I would describe as embarrassed silence. And that motivated me to find the answer. So that was even more so than just a simple question. It was the answers I received that motivated me. Now, as far as your question as to the numbers of people that worked for the Stasi when the wall came down, which, of course, was in 1989 and unification following the year after that, there was roughly 100,000 employees that worked for the Ministry for State Security, the Stasi, or as the officers like to call it, the firm. Of those 100,000, nobody really knows the exact number of officers, but the best estimate by a Stasi expert is that approximately 75,000 of those were officers, all very carefully selected and very well trained, very well educated. In 1990, there had already, when the unification agreement was concluded, approximately 60,000 of those former officers went out looking for new careers. And that's where the adventure starts as far as where these people went, and more importantly, the people that don't want to talk about where they went.
And how did someone become a Stasi officer? Like what were the sort of, was it open to anyone? What were the kind of qualities that made people do this? How long did you have to serve before you became an officer?
Well, you didn't walk in the door and fill out a job application. That was virtually unheard of because, of course, like many secret police agencies, they are very suspicious. So they selected people. They reached out. There would be, a university student that was doing particularly well. He might get a visit and be given what they describe as an opportunity to serve the GDR. Many times they hired children of current Stasi officers who grew up, and because that was safe. They felt that was safe and that they were less likely to be penetrated by external security services. And to be fair, when the wall came down, most security services at that time, including the U.S. intelligence agencies, thought that they perhaps had 25,000 officers, which would have been a huge amount for a country that size, roughly the size of Florida. But they were off. The U.S. intelligence and the other intelligence agencies were off by a factor of four.
Okay, that's pretty significant. Thank you for explaining that. And you then, obviously, in the book, you go into much more detail. So I would definitely recommend reading the book to get those details, as we're not going to be able to cover all of them in the interview. And you describe kind of what happens to the Stasi both immediately before the wall falls and then in those kind of initial few chaotic moments of going, oh no, hang on, what's actually happening? And perhaps unsurprisingly, the Stasi try to destroy their files before they're taken away. And people realize that. And so there's these citizens committees that you describe that occupy Stasi buildings in order to protect the files. And there's this big kind of effort made right when the wall comes down to sort of preserve the evidence in a way. And yet, as you detail in the book, despite these committees literally occupying the buildings, despite the kind of known idea of we have to make sure these files are saved, the files do continue to be destroyed or moved or essentially not protected. How is that actually possible, though, when officially, at least, the organization no longer exists?
Well, you know, you mentioned that what happened to these officers, you know, what were they thinking when this started to unravel? And the reality of it was that many were surprised, but many were not. There had been preparations underway for some years because the writing was seen on the wall that something was going to happen. I don't think anybody guessed that it would happen this quickly. Again, certainly not U.S. intelligence services or foreign intelligence services either, and not generally the Stasi. But there had been preparations made as to what they would do if something happened. And part of that was to destroy the files, destroy as much of the most incriminating files as possible. When you have 120 kilometers of paper files, that's not an easy task. In today's world, a flick of a wrist could destroy all of those files that are digital. But then the Stasi operated as prolific collectors of information, but in a pre-digital age. So that caused a problem for them. And when the peaceful revolution, as it was called at the time, started kind of in grassroots citizens getting together and starting actually in Leipzig in a church, and with people gathering with candles talking about politics in a church, because that was one of the few safer places they could do that. And then they spilled out into the streets, and these people and their candles were the ones that defeated the GDR and defeated the Stasi organization, at least. Once that started to happen, then the Stasi were in full destruction mode. They were destroying files in all the district offices 24 hours a day. They wanted to burn them, but they didn't feel comfortable doing that because they felt that their offices were being watched and that smoke billowing out in the back would be, you know, could precipitate something bad happening. So they kept to shred, and shredding they did, burned out hundreds of shredders. More than that were found scattered around. Unfortunately, they used East German shredders, which maybe weren't quite as robust as the West German version. And so they continued to shred and continued to shred by using a criteria that to this day is unknown as to what they shredded first. It's believed that what was shredded first probably related to very sensitive information involving kidnapping, assassinations, and so forth, very sensitive sources that they operated. But nobody really knows. But they left 18,000 bags of shredded or torn files. Once the shredders burned out, they tore the papers. And they tore them up quite well, but it turns out that technology can solve reassembly, even when documents are shredded, and certainly when they're torn. But they decided to, once the citizen groups took over the main Stasi headquarters in Berlin, where most of the files were being held at that time, the Stasi officers offered to help the occupiers, the citizen committee. And they did that by saying, look, there's a lot of, you know, sources that we have, and if this gets out, then people are going to be get the electric chair in America. And the Citizens Committee members were kind of an informal ragtag group that weren't particularly sophisticated, didn't know really what they were looking at. Were trying to do the right thing, obviously, but they weren't very much particularly favorites of America at that time. So they didn't want people to get electric chair in America, and they allowed the Stasi officers to continue to shred files that they said would protect these sources. And it was during that period of almost a year that the Stasi supervised files continuing to get shredded, even after, up until unification and slightly after that. It turns out that when they were shredding files, the foreign intelligence arm of the Stasi also threw some other files into the mix, and that was all of their own personnel files. And that was part of their plan that they had to start fresh. It would have worked, and it should have. However, there was another file identifying them, all Stasi officers, that their file archivist used to file documents, and a typical officer have no reason to know about that. That file was found later, which identified every serving Stasi officer.
So this list that identifies everyone obviously becomes quite important for a number of reasons, and yet you show in the book that essentially tell us how and why it was and was not used. If it does identify everyone who's an officer, surely the logic would go that you can therefore track these people down, put them on trial, et cetera, et cetera. And yet that's not what happens. So what does and does not happen with this list and why?
Well, there's actually two lists per se. The list I referred to previously was actually a file that was used, like a 3 or 4 page file. It's called a central card file. That had a lot of information about each officer, where they had served, what they had done, what awards they had received. It was like a summary of their personnel file. So the Stasi Foreign Intelligence Division, called the HVA, shredded all of the officer personnel files within their division. They were the elite within the elite. And so, but then it was the central card files that were found much later that actually had that detailed information of even those Stasi officers. Now, while this was going on with the chaos at the Stasi headquarters, with the citizens groups milling around the offices trying to, preserve things that they thought were important, which, you know, they didn't really know, you know, who could say what's in a file. It was at that time that several Stasi officers successfully removed from that headquarters a bag containing some magnetic tapes, which that included the identifying information of every Stasi officer. And the reason they did that was they wanted to ensure in the new Germany they would all get pensions. And they felt there had to be evidence somewhere, just evidence that they, so when they filed their pension claims, the 100,000 could be entitled to a pension from the unified Germany. So they took those magnetic tapes in a bag under the noses of the citizen groups, took it, put it in a car, drove it out to an old GDR army base not far from Berlin, where they had other officers who were technically able to extract names and create a database, would be the equivalent today of an Excel spreadsheet showing the officers' names, not all the information basically just that they worked and when they worked. And the idea was it would be presented at some later date by these officers as proof. Well, again, that nearly worked. They did get it converted, but there was an anonymous phone call made when they were busy at the army base. That anonymous phone call, which to this day nobody knows where it came from, alerted the Citizens Committee group back in central Berlin what was going on. And they became enraged that somebody had taken something, and they all showed up at the army base. In all the confusion, they were let in, and they seized these records, this database. the officers there said, well, you know, if you do this, people are going to die, and the usual excuses that were offered. But it didn't work this time. The citizen committee seized the database. They provided it to a trusted politician who locked it in a safe, who then turned it over to West German authorities. Soon after that, the leak started. And before long, you could find a complete list of everybody that served in the Stasi for a short period of time in Germany. That list is impossible to find now. And that's because of the German privacy laws and the EU privacy laws, which make it, which actually work in the favor of the former Stasi officers.
So then, but this knowledge was available at some time. So why then have so few people who work for the Stasi have had legal processes against them, gone to court, gone to trial? It would seem like maybe the reason would be, okay, we don't know who they are, but there is this list. So can you explain, obviously with less detail than you do in the book, but can you explain to our listeners why, despite having this list, there wasn't a lot of legal follow-up?
Well, there were many, many criminal investigations opened, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds. Very few of those resulted in any charges, and even fewer of those resulted in any Stasi officer being convicted. And of those, there was only one Stasi officer who actually went to prison for something they did in the Stasi. And there are many reasons for that. Fear and embarrassment is one of the reasons. A lot of the stuff from the files were missing. Was concerning to people, not only West Germany and Europe, and even the United States, and certainly in the UK. And so in the rush to unification, they were hoping to sweep away a lot of things and hoping that many, many people, even government, hoped that all this would just go away. So there were very few successful prosecutions. You can count on one hand, and only one officer that went to prison. And that is a fact that is very difficult to find in Germany. It's not known to the average German, I would say. And I think some of the people I spoke to in government also didn't know that, which was surprising.
Why is it so little known?
One reason is nobody wants to know. And if they start asking those kind of questions again, there are very active Stasi, former Stasi organizations that are active today that will stage protests, that will marshal many people to show up, or that will make anonymous threatening calls to politicians or journalists. And that's today. I mean, 2019, 2020, the fear continues. And frankly, not only did a lot of files disappear, but a lot of money disappeared too. And I think there are still people that are concerned as to what is in those files, that could possibly either be embarrassing to them from their private life, or identify them as possibly cooperating with the Stasi. So, a large numbers are trying to still wish this away. And I've had journalists tell me that if they try to investigate too much, then they also are subject to threats and intimidation. And again, this is 35, 40 years later.
Hmm. No, quite a powerful idea of how much strength that organization held, and then kind of what happened next. So before I ask you to tell us about kind of some of the people that you were able to track down that happened, what happened to them afterwards, I want to pick up on something you mentioned an answer ago about the impact of German and EU privacy laws. And you detail in the book that on a particular day in November 2008, German Wikipedia was turned off. What does that have to do with the Stasi?
It was turned off because of an injunction that was applied for in a German court by a former Stasi officer who was upset because he was identified as being a former Stasi officer, which of course is true. He was a former Stasi officer. So under the German privacy law, he could say this was causes problems for him. It invades his privacy. And so he filed with a German court in Lübeck and was received this a successful injunction, which he served on Wikipedia, and they promptly turned Wikipedia off. Now, this particular former Stasi officer by the name of Lutz Hellmann, he was very active in the left party in politics. And unfortunately, this action backfired because when Wikipedia turned off, people asked why. And when they found out the answer, a lot more people knew that he had been a Stasi officer than would have if he would have said nothing. So it was shortly after that, it was turned back on, but it was enough to bring it, elevate it to people's attention, to the average person who maybe didn't know anything, a younger person, about the Stasi or didn't care. But then when Wikipedia went off, they were curious, and this is what they found out about this officer.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Interesting. So what then can you tell us about what has happened to some of these former officers? What have they kind of gone on to do with these records not being brought up, or with perhaps with some of the money that disappeared? Kind of where have some of these people ended up?
Well, you know, many Stasi officers, due to their nature of being educated, extremely motivated, and being used to having their way for years, not surprisingly, went on to success elsewhere. Not all did, but many did. And some ended up in the Russian energy machine at very high level and remain there today. Some succeeded in business. Many started practicing law. They had been given a law degree by the Stasi University, as it was called, in Potsdam. And under the unification agreement, they could just practice law in unified Germany after filling out a form. The only problem with that was that, of course, in the Stasi University, they weren't trained to represent clients. They were trained to protect the state. But thousands of new lawyers popped up. Many people former Stasi officers went to work in banking, working for police, a large number of police. I think there are still some working in police now. Some of them found a niche working at the Stasi archives, where all the records were. And they were worked for years there. I believe as of a few years ago, there were still four or five employed there. They scattered across Europe and across the world. Some even went to America and the UK. And then they proceeded to try to hide behind these privacy laws, which basically made it impossible for them to be outed as a Stasi officer, certainly in Germany, because they could then file a complaint with the appropriate department saying their privacy had been violated. And the person who published the information would get a very onerous letter threatening fines. And in many cases, these were prior victims who had been in prison, interrogated, and operated websites to talk to other victims. And if they identified a Stasi officer, they could be threatened with fines. So in effect, the victims were victimized once again, and the former Stasi officers hid behind German and then the later EU privacy protections.
Hmm. And combined then what we were talking about earlier in terms of kind of threatening phone calls and that sort of thing, these strands sort of combine, and you discuss them in the book under the idea of Stasi revisionism, among other aspects. Can you tell us about kind of how this overall push by former Stasi employees, how has that impacted how the GDR as a whole is remembered? Or I suppose the other way of phrasing the question is, can you tell us about, apologies for mispronouncing, I'm sure I will, but can you tell us about Hubertus Knaap, who he was, what he was trying to do, and then why he lost his job?
Yes, I mean, just overall, it's very difficult in Germany, and even in some places that aren't in Germany, in Europe, to criticize communism, to criticize the GDR. And it's I've had quite high placed people, even within the current German government, who told me that, you know, it's safe to criticize the Nazi period, and it's fine. You can do that every day of the week. But if you, the minute you criticize the GDR or communism, then there are demonstrations, then the calls come, and there are threats. And so it's easier for them not to address that. And, you know, the curious thing when you, Berlin is called the City of Remembrance. That's what it's called. It's referred to that. I mean, but it's a remembrance, but you're only really supposed to remember certain things. And that's kind of the untold truth, one of the untold truths there. And if you want to have a memorial, which some people have on occasion tried to have a memorial to the victims of communism or the victims of the Stasi, seemed, you know, pretty straightforward for Berlin, which has memorials everywhere. But every time they try to have that kind of memorial, large protests, they march the former Stasi organizations and the heir to the GDR Communist Party, which is still in Germany, marshals large opposition. So that's the Germany of today, and that's surprising. There's a lot of hushed conversation, a lot of discouragement for people to discuss the things that should be discussed. Hubertus Knaap was a man who was born a free man, just barely, because his parents crossed over from East Berlin to West Berlin shortly before the wall went up. They all knew something was going to happen at that time. Nobody knew what it was going to be, but his father decided that they should cross with the other children. And so his mother was pregnant with him, and they stepped across the line, which you could do then before the wall was up. It was still risky because you had Stasi officers hanging around that would question you, interrogate you. Certainly, you couldn't have suitcases. You would be stopped even without the wall. And so he was born as a free man. But when he grew up, he chose to fight anyway. And he became a very good student of history. He studied and eventually got a PhD. In West Berlin, and he started visiting East Berlin as part of this, which you could do then for a weekend, primarily because the GDR wanted hard currency, which you had to convert at their official rate when you arrived. And he met a woman, as what happens sometimes, and then he became more closely connected to the GDR and became more determined to return, because he and people in his generation had seen many former Nazis appear in German government after World War II. And it was frustrating. And they were quite sure that this time it would be different, that this time that wouldn't happen. And they were disappointed. And he was disappointed. But he continued to pursue this. And when the wall suddenly tumbled shortly after that, he became the first lead historian at the Stasi archives. And it was there that he started to conduct his own research and started to talk about things that people didn't like, such as where these officers went, what they were doing, who was a former Stasi informant. And he started facing mounting underground resistance. People would, even within the archives where there were Stasi officers then, people that would call him Stasi hunter or things like that behind his back. And so at one point, a solution presented itself to the people that opposed him, and that was to put him as the director of a museum. And that museum was the old Stasi prison in the region called Holzenhausen, which is just outside of central Berlin. And it was a museum that basically nobody visited because it was an old prison, and old prisons are kind of dangerous to visit if they're not fixed up properly. And it was not easy to get there. It wasn't, and it wasn't publicly known. And so they told him, look, we're going to make you as director. And to their surprise, he jumped at the chance. And they were happy because he wouldn't have any files out there. And he'd be out there in an old prison, and they felt everything would be taken care of. But he decided that he wasn't going to make it a museum. He was going to make it a memorial. And by doing that, not only did he fix it up exactly like the prison was when the Stasi operated it, but he hired former inmates to give tours. And before long, after the first year, there were 100,000 visitors, and then it later became one of the most visited Cold War sites in Europe, actually. And so that was, and he served there for quite some time until, I believe, 2018.
And then?
And then he was forced out, and the details of which I'll refer your readers to the book. Suffice it to say that it had many of the hallmarks of an operation run by a Stasi group, a Stasi organization, and even to former victims, it appeared to be that they were still active and that they had done this. And but again, you know, to his credit, even though he was forced out for for an indirect reason, he's continued to do the same thing with his own personal platform and at higher risk with virtually no protections. You know, he's not in an official capacity. And he was forced out. One of the things, he had been working on a new project at the time, which he had decided that it wasn't enough to talk about the Stasi, because he saw what was happening in the present day, and he wanted to talk about what was happening in the present day, not only what the former Stasi officers were doing, but also what the former members of the SED, the former East German Communist Party, were doing. That party changed its name a couple times and is now known as the Left Party in Germany. And so he would continue to publish things about that. And so he continued to be a threat. So it was yet another instance of where an attempt to keep him quiet didn't work. And so he's a man who has chosen to keep fighting against the Stasi, former Stasi officers, their organizations, and the former SED Communist Party officials for 35, 40 years past when the wall fell down, it came down.
Hmm. Thank you for explaining that and expanding. And of course, as you said, there are a lot of more details in the book. So definitely recommend that if you're curious about kind of what Ralph, you thankfully already told us a bit about. So kind of to stay in the present day to an extent, right? You were talking about how he got forced out of his position in 2018, right? That's quite recent. Similarly, in the book, you talk about how Germany is still paying pensions to former Stasi employees, in fact, worth $300 million a year. Why?
Yeah, I mean, actually, it's I believe it's more like 350 million euros, and that fact was another fact that was difficult to find. The months that I spent in Berlin, I talked to a lot of people in government and even some journalists, and I would ask, you know, are they getting pensions? And the answer was, yeah, they're getting pensions. Well, how much and how many's getting them? And nobody seemed to know. So I went to the German pension office and I talked to somebody there who, it turns out that there is, you know, certain information that's public. And I determined that in 2017 that 66,077 former Stasi officers were receiving pensions and they were living all over the world. Coincidentally, if you're a Stasi victim and you're imprisoned for more than a certain amount of time, you can apply and get 300 euros a month, which is a tiny amount. And only if they go through the process of determining they're unjustly convicted and basically opening up the whole experience again. And if they're only if they're financially destitute. But none of those criteria apply to the former Stasi officers who receive pensions many, many times that amount and without any such restrictions.
That is a rather large discrepancy. So I was quite interested to see that in the book, that's kind of a systemic aspect of sort of what you're generally talking about, that the Stasi is maybe not as gone as we might like to think. And kind of in that vein, there's one section towards the end of the book that you have a really interesting kind of thought experiment to a degree, where you think about what the Stasi would be like if it still existed, right? How would the organization have adapted? What would it look like if it was in the 21st century, if it had, you know, had the technology to move beyond those thousands and thousands of pages, millions of pages of paper documents? So could you tell us a little bit about kind of what you think after doing all this research, after your career, what do you think the Stasi would be like as a 21st century organization?
Well, when that question popped up, I was sitting in a Stasi organization speaking to a former Stasi officer. So I asked him directly that question. What would you have done, the kind of the internet being more prevalent, being social media, would you have adapted and what, you know, and his immediate proud response was, we would have adapted quite easily, I expect. And I believe that to be true. And so I started thinking a bit more about after and speaking to some people, not only in the German government, but other intelligence agencies and looking at my experience. It's was clear that what we see now happening in China is very, very, gives us a window into what the Stasi would have continued to do had they been in 2020. The Chinese Communist government is still very, very favorably connected to the old GDR communism. In fact, it was just a couple of years ago that they provided a statue to the town of Trier, in the town of Trier, Germany, a statue of Karl Marx, the German founder of global communism. And they frequently make, the premier in China frequently makes mention to German communism as not a failed experience, but as something that didn't fail. And what China has done now is to create an internet Berlin Wall that can be extended around citizens of theirs or other countries anywhere in the world using technology. And I believe it's that is a technology that the Stasi, of course, would have adapted to. The former Stasi officer bragged to me that they were already hacking into computers of other governments in the late 80s. And that was in the very early days, even in the U.S. and other Western countries, of being able to do that. They were very well financed, had unquestioned authority, and could do anything without fear of any actions. So with that, you know, bad things happen. And that's what, of course, you see that in China. And you see them I discuss a little bit in the book, you know, they've developed an app to help put a wall around citizens that can be set up quickly. They are using social scores. And you see even talk in Western countries of using social scores. And all of those things, of course, and Stasi officers told me, would have been a dream come true for them. They have told me that it would have been so much easier to accumulate information about people now, of course, than it is then because of, technology, social media, and a variety of things. So in many ways, their job would have been easier. And that would be the Stasi in the 21st century would have been much more ruthless, effective, and much very similar to what we see in China and a couple other places around the world.
Interesting. It's particularly interesting kind of that you were able to ask that question as well to people, in addition to obviously being able to tell us that answer. So thank you for sharing that with us. As we move towards the end of the interview, I sort of have a few kind of traditional wrap-up questions that are always really interesting, given how much work and particularly in this case, how many conversations you had with people involved and things like that. So is there anything that came up in the kind of creation, the process of this book that surprised you?
Yeah, there were a number of things. The first thing is just how active the Stasi organizations are still. These organizations, which were set up immediately after, or actually during the process of unification in 1990, you know, were set up for a number of reasons. One is to support the Stasi officers in their new ventures. Another was to support the politicians of the former SED as they continued their political career. They're still doing that now. I was standing in a different Stasi organization office, and I observed a couple of former Stasi officers working on a current campaign for a member of the Left Party. And this was in probably 2019. And the other reason that these organizations were set up was to commence a revisionist element to convince people, students, media, that, you know, communism wasn't that bad. It was misunderstood. It was quaint. It was harmless. And so as doing that, they do cooperate with, movies that are sometimes made referencing the Stasi, as long as the message is correct. One of those, just as an aside that I can mention that your listeners may have heard of, is a movie called The Lives of Others. A good movie, a very good movie in many ways. It's popular outside, in the U.S. and in the U.K., many places, as it shows the chilling nature of the Stasi as the level of penetration that they had. The movie's not very popular in Germany, and the reason is because it makes several technical mistakes. The movie was given technical advice by one of the Stasi organizations. And one of the major bits of error that it makes is that it portrays one of the, I guess you could say the hero, was a Stasi captain who decided that enough was enough. He wasn't going to support the destruction of an artist. And so he took action to defeat the investigation and to make sure the artist wasn't imprisoned. In reality, that had never been known to occur in any of the 40-year history of the Stasi, which is why the Germans, anybody who knows, immediately dismisses that aspect. So that was all things that were interesting on how those organizations were active. Also, it was interesting to find out how these active organizations are still in contact in some cases with former Stasi informants or even spies. It came up during my conversation with a Stasi officer that they were in contact with former Stasi spies who actually were convicted of espionage in the United States and got out of prison just a few years ago. So, you know, this, all of those things, when you sit down in one of these offices, you don't feel that the organizations have gone away. You don't feel that the Stasi has really gone away. And, you know, you walk down these old buildings, down the linoleum, type of linoleum that you see in old Eastern, former Eastern European government offices, and you go into this room, and as I did, and I see on the wall a huge picture of Vladimir Lenin in their conference room, okay, in 2019. I see in a different office a newsletter where they are celebrating what they call the scientific career of one of their favorite Americans, somebody called Angela Davis. Communist Party USA was tried for being involved in a kidnapping of providing weapons to a group that kidnapped and ultimately shot and killed a Superior Court judge in California. And so, you know, it doesn't feel like, it, you know, that they, and they certainly don't feel that they've gone anywhere. They still are, their phone's ringing off the hook. All of those things were surprising. And I think I would say the third thing that surprised me was the level of hush that there still is in Germany and even in other places in Europe about talking about certain Stasi officers, that they don't want to know where these officers ended up. And, you know, as an investigator, it's a very easy initial thing to take a list of all these officers, especially today, and just compare it against employment roles, you know, electronically in Germany and in Europe. And then you would quickly see out of the 70,000 people, you know, who might be a problem. I mean, it's not necessarily a problem to have been a former Stasi officer, but if there's not transparency, it very well could be a problem. And, but there's never been an attempt to do this. And I think that it wouldn't be possible under German law now. Under German law, you can't even have a copy of the Stasi list and put it on your website. You'll be fined, a large fine. And so you can't find the list of Stasi officers in Germany. But virtually everybody, many people have private copies, but they won't talk about it and they won't publish it. And this is 35, 40 years later. That was surprising. There's been no resolution. Right now, there is the revisionist element of the Stasi organizations that continue to try to dispute the facts. They send people on tour groups to pretend to be tourists at the old Stasi prisons and to dispute what the victims who are the tour guides, who are frequently victims, former prisoners, will say about being in the prison. So this is all happening now. And those were surprising. This isn't history per se. This is present day.
I think that's a really great point to sort of bring the interview almost to an end, because I think that is something that comes through really clearly, is that some of these events might be historical, but they're still very much real and present, in some ways more so than they were in the immediate aftermath of the fall of the Berlin Wall. But to some degree, while the events are obviously still ongoing and there's a lot of unresolved things, one thing that is somewhat resolved is the book, right? It's obviously published and it's out now. So what are you working on now that it's done, or what are you kind of doing next?
Well, Miranda, I'm working on another project, which is quite different. It's not ready to be discussed yet, unfortunately. There are some sensitive things that could go either way. You know, I will say that it doesn't involve Germany, but it is, it's, you know, something in my kind of area of experience. Let's just say that.
Fair enough. Well, best of luck with that new effort. And in the meantime, listeners can read the book we've been discussing titled The Grey Men, Pursuing the Stasi into the Present, published by One World in 2022. Ralph Hope, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Miranda.